Hi, you're listening to Screen of the Crime, a podcast where we talk about true crime and what would happen if your favorite TV or movie characters committed those crimes. Hi, it's Maggie. So this week I am incredibly busy. I took on some extra hours of work and I have a lot of schoolwork happening right now. So sadly this episode will be a mini-sode because I don't have time to record a normal episode. Please do listen to this and enjoy it. At the end I will include Cold the Air from last week's sister screaming about LED lights and silverfish because he told me she felt left out that I cut her out of the last episode because she came in while we were recording. So stay tuned till the end and you can hear her screaming about what the TikTok that she saw. So I got these Reddit No Sleep stories from coolmaterials.com under the title, The Scariest Stories from Reddit's No Sleep subreddit. So the first story we have is The Limping Woman. It was posted by Pippinacious on August 16th, 2 years ago. So let's get into it. You hear the uneven footsteps first, drag, click, drag, click. That's how you know she's behind you. The heel is broken off of her left shoe, and she drags it across the ground with every step. A sharp contrast to the steady click of her still intact pump. Help me, she whispers. It's an urgent, anguished plea. Please, I'm hurt. Help me. Don't turn around, that's when she gets you. Don't run, she still gets you. But this time, she's going to make it hurt. At least, that's the rumor anyway. Every small town has at least one, a local urban legend that everyone knows and swears is true because their sister's best friend's cousin's neighbor's grandson knew a fellow who actually encountered it. Ours was the Limping Woman, so named for her aforementioned distinct gait. It was said that she was a teacher at the elementary school some decades before, young, beautiful, and a victim of a terrible murder. She had been walking home to the house she shared with her parents one night. After school, when she realized she was being followed, she sped up, and so did her pursuer, until both were running down this dark country lane with only open farmland on either side. Her heel broke, and her ankle snapped, and she fell, and her pursuer became her murderer. It was a slow, torturous affair that left her beaten and covered in stab wounds, and, when the killer was done, he just left her to bleed out beside the road. She wasn't found until the next morning, and, by then, all anyone could do was search for the person responsible. While some believe the man was caught and dealt with not long after, others think he or she is still at large, and the Limping Woman, as the victim came to be known, won't rest until her killer is caught. I was skeptical, at best, of the story. I'd passed a spot where she was supposed to appear 100 times without incident, as did everyone else I knew. If a murderous ghost lived there, I was pretty sure I'd have seen her. I said as much as my friend Steffi when she brought up that a friend of hers and a friend had met the Limping Woman during lunch at school one day. It's true, she was out on the old highway a couple nights ago. I saw her, Steffi insisted stubbornly, over our sandwiches. If she actually saw her, wouldn't she be dead, I asked. I thought you weren't supposed to turn around. Hurt her. Whatever, you know what I mean, Rena. Sure, I said, with a roll of my eyes. It always frustrated Steffi that I didn't share her willingness to believe the unbelievable. So how'd she get away? She said the words, duh. All right, the woman's last words. Last words we all somehow know without her having caught the one person who would have heard them. We know because the real killer was never caught. He told people who told other people. And we all just magically knew to use them to ward off being killed, I finished for her. Steffi frowned. She loved all things spooky and the supernatural and had spent a lot of time researching our local legends, especially the Limping Woman. It's not magic. It just reminds her of her own mother, and she gets distracted by her grief and leaves you alone. Okay, I said, hoping that would be enough for her to put an end to the topic. It was an argument neither of us would win, and I didn't feel like getting into it again over whether or not the ghost was real. At 15, it was starting to feel silly. Steffi, however, wasn't going to let me off so easily. They say she remains because they got the wrong guy, and she's angry about it, like everyone knew it, but no one cared because they wanted to blame someone. Don't you feel at least a little bad for her? She's still waiting for justice after all this time. Steffi. Shelly goes after people who don't believe in her, you know. I don't like the way Steffi said that, like she had an idea forming that I wouldn't approve of. And I shook my head. Whatever it is, no. We could go out there, out to the spot she haunts. No, don't be dumb, I said. You don't believe anyway, so what's the big deal? I've walked past that a lot, okay? Nothing ever happened. Have you gone after dark? Steffi had started to smile. No, but so what? That was when she's active. Going in the day doesn't count. This is dumb, I said. We'll go tonight. Every argument I had was met with questions of whether I was too afraid, and Steffi mocking me for being a chicken. She kept it up for the rest of lunch, through a shared science class, and then passed me notes in the hall between classes after that. By the time the final bell rang, she had worn me down. But not because I believe she's there. I made sure she knew. But I'm just going to shut you up. The sun set just after 5 that evening. At 7, we met up on our bikes in front of my neighborhood. My parents thought she was doing a project at mine. Mine thought I was at hers. And we had 2 hours to ride out to the farm where the limping woman was said to haunt and get back before they started trading phone calls. We pedaled hard and fast, leaving behind the glow from windows and street lamps until darkness swallowed up the world around us. With only moonlight to guide us, we wove our way across town, past on into the outskirts where the insects were louder, the stars brighter, and the safety that came from feeling like you were surrounded by other people fell away. It was not hard to feel entirely exposed out on that old road, where the flat fields rolled off into the distance. On either side, there was the occasional barn or farmhouse set away off long, dusty drives, but otherwise it was really just us and our bikes in the night. Up ahead, Steffi said, from behind me, "See the cross? That's the marker for her." We skid to a stop a few yards away from it and exchanged a glance, almost lost in the shadows. "Scared?" she asked, breathless with excitement. "No," I said. It was an honest enough answer. I was nervous, sure, but who wouldn't be when you're outside after dark? Remember, if you turn around, she gets you. If you try to run, she makes it worse. Just stand still when she's close by and say the words. Steffi spoke so seriously that I had to stifle a giggle. It was ridiculous. I kept trying to tell to all the butterflies stirring in my stomach, but it didn't do much. We climbed off our bikes and set them on their kickstands. Steffi groped out for my hand and intertwined her fingers with mine. She was shaking. Ready? Let's get it over with, I replied. She walked up to where the cross was placed and paused. Steffi squeezed my hand and took in a slow, shuddering breath, her fear starting to have an effect on me, quickening my heartbeat, but I squared my shoulders and I clenched my jaw and I took a step forward. We crept along the roadside, careful to keep our eyes pointed straight ahead. Steffi kept reminding me in a trembling whisper that looking anywhere else could lead to trouble. A minute or two passed. It couldn't have been longer, despite feeling like it, and nothing seemed to happen. My fear began to ebb, replaced by admittedly relieved giddiness that I had been right, and I almost turned to Steffi to say, "I told you." Then I realized how quiet it was. All the insects that had been singing loudly when we arrived had gone silent. There was no distant calls from night birds, no breeze passing by us, nothing. Just the sound of our own breathing. To my surprise, Steffi sighed, disappointed. I wonder if she realized how quiet everything had become. How could she not feel how claustrophobic it had become out on the open road, how close off we were in the dark and the silence? I wanted to ask her, but the question was like a knot in my throat that I couldn't untangle. Behind us, grass rustled, followed by a crunch of loose gravel underfoot, like someone was pulling themselves slowly out of the field and onto the road. Drag, click, drag, click. Every hair on my body stood up at once. Rena. I hadn't realized that my grip on Steffi's hand had tightened so much. I could feel her eyes on me, but I couldn't bring myself to look at her. From somewhere over my shoulder, a woman started to sob softly. "Help me," she cried plaintively. "Rena," Steffi said again. "She's coming," I managed to whisper. Instead of being scared, Steffi started. "Real funny. I get it, okay? The limping woman is just made up. I'm convinced now. You don't have to rub it in. Drag, click. Drag, click." The unmistakable sound of someone inching towards us, slowly, painfully, crying out with each step. Please, she begged. I'm hurt, and he's still out there. Steffi, I hissed, tears burning in my eyes. She's coming. There must have been something in my voice, a tightness that only true terror could cause, that convinced my friend that I wasn't just pretending. She grabbed my forearm with her hand and clutched it until her nails were digging into my skin. She only goes after people who don't believe, Steffi said. That must be why. What do I do? I begged, my voice white and blank. My entire body was screaming to run, to get away from that thing that was getting closer and closer, but Steffi's firm grasp and my own mounting dread held me in place. Please, the limping woman sobbed. Turn around. Help me. The words, Steffi said hurriedly. You have to say the words when she's right behind you. What words? I wanted to scream, but I couldn't speak or think. I could only hear her. Drag, click, drag, click. The legend said you'd hear her uneven footsteps and be forced to listen to her pleas, but no one ever mentioned the smell, the scent of rot and earth and blood and ooze through the air, slowly surrounding me and wrapping itself around me like tentacles, smothering me. I gagged and pressed my free hand over my mouth and shook my head violently, trying to clear it, trying to make sense of things. Steffi was jerking on my arm and saying something to me over and over again, but I could barely hear her over the limping woman's cries. The smell was getting so strong, making my stomach pitch and heave until I thought I'd be sick. I leaned heavily on Steffi, and she pulled me in close so that her lips were beside my ear. Through the veil of panic and nausea, I heard her scream, "Say the words." Drag, click, drag, click. The limping woman was so close behind me now that I could feel the chill radiating off of her. The words, I thought, I had to say the words. It just reminds her of her own mother, and she gets distracted by her grief and leaves you alone. I heard Steffi's voice from the previous day echo in my head. Her mother. The words reminded her of her mother, the limping woman's last words. Please, bile rose in the back of my throat. My mother's waiting for me. The footsteps stopped and were replaced by high-pitched, heart-wrenching keen. From somewhere off in the night, a dog started to howl. Insects began to sing again. The wind whistled across the field, sounds of normalcy, of life. The limping woman continued to screech while I found my legs again and with Steffi in tow tore back to the bikes, never once looked up from the ground. The only thing I saw as we darted by was a pair of feet in torn stockings and pumps, the heel of one which was missing. We didn't stop riding until I made it back to my lawn. When we got there, I raced to the bushes on the side of the house and vomited. Steffi claimed she didn't hear or see anything that night, but she believed that I did, believed that I encountered the limping woman. I tried to come up with some kind of rationalization for it, like power of suggestion or something, but when I think back to those footsteps and those sobs and that final scream, I know there was only one explanation, and now I too believe in the limping woman. Okay, time for the second one. I like that one. It was pretty short. It was nice. It was sweet. Some of the comments I can read to you, because why not? Let's do that. So, Chility from 2 years ago said, maybe during the day you could leave her a gift of running shoes so she doesn't have to limp around helpless anymore. And then We All Float Georgie, clearly an It reference, replied to that and said, her ankle snapped as well, remember? Yeah, dumbass. And then Chility continues, this is a full conversation, said, add in some strapping tape and painkillers. And then whoever's account's deleted, it said, ah, yes, painkillers. Reminds me of Max Payne, nothing like pumping yourself with ibuprofen before shooting people in slow-mo. Burbamoth said, I remember that a friend of mine sent me this fucking link. Now I live in constant fear. Bold6320 said, I don't get it. Why do people find it terrifying? Okay, sure, it's creepy, but there are way more scarier things on the internet. So this is The Quiet Neighbor. This is actually by, looks like the same person, Pippinacious. A lot of things happen to Pippinacious for some reason. This was posted 2 years ago, too. Just about the first thing anyone new to the neighborhood learned was to avoid Bud Fillmore. Cantankerous, territorial, and fueled by what seemed to be a deep-seated hatred for just about everything. He was the kind of man that childhood nightmares were made of. Although he only lived there for a few months longer than us, by the time my family moved in across the street from the Fillmore house, his reputation was already firmly established. When other neighbors came by with their cookies and casseroles to welcome us and saw me and my brother, just 9 and 11, they pulled my parents aside and offered hushed warnings. "Keep them away from that nasty little man across the street," Mrs. Devon said. "He can't stand children." "My son, Bill, swears Bud tried to run him down with his car," Mr. Crane said. "He'll look for any excuse to yell at them. He says the most terrible things," Mrs. Paul said. My parents thanked them, but I don't think they quite believed them. My mother especially wasn't fond of gossip, and she tried to take such rumors with a grain of salt until she could make her own decisions. She didn't have to wait long. My older brother, Scotty, and I were outside tossing a baseball back and forth one Saturday morning when Scotty tossed it a little too hard and a little too high, and it sailed over my head, bounced on the street, and rolled to the stop at the very edge of Mr. Fillmore's yard. Both of us had overheard our neighbor's warnings and were hesitant to even look at the house, much less approach it. "Go get it, Liz," Scotty said, nudging my shoulder. "But you threw it," I replied. "So you missed it." I couldn't reach it. My whining had no effect, and he pushed me towards the road. After checking both ways, I began to creep across towards our ball. I almost reached it and just had to take a couple more steps, and would have been within my grasp when the front door of the house flew open. "What the hell are you doing?" A stout man with thin, graying hair came bursting outside and stomping across his lawn towards me. My ball," I tried to say, pointing to it. "The brat's throwing things at my house. Think it would be fun to break a window?" "No," I glanced over my shoulder to see Scotty half poised to run inside and whimpered. "Get out of here," Mr. Fillmore snapped. "Can I just—" "No." Before I could react, he scooped up the baseball, which had barely even touched his grass, and stormed back inside. The whole front of his house seemed to shake with the force of him slamming the door.
"Sounds a lot like Monster House, if you ask me."
That's my own comment. It was the first of what would be many run-ins with everyone's least favorite neighbor. Our parents tried to talk to him about his behavior, but he just told them to keep their nosy little shits off his lawn and away from his house, and if we didn't want trouble. Dad thought about calling the cops on him, but as Mom became fond of saying, there's no law against being rude, so we were told to just try and be more careful. "He must not have always been such a bull," Mom said over dinner about a month after we moved in. "He's married, you know." Dad scoffed. "Oh yeah? How do you know?" Dolores Devons was by again for a chat and came up. "Bud wears a ring, and she said she sees Mrs. Fillmore looking out the window from time to time, but the poor woman never comes outside. She thinks she heard Bud say it was cancer once." "Poor lady's sick and married to that," Dad said. "Terrible, isn't it? But it doesn't explain a bit about him. He's just trying to keep things quiet and peaceful around the house." "Yeah, sure," Scotty muttered, and Mom frowned at him. "He's probably very sad and lashes out without even meaning to."
"He's an asshole," Scotty said.
"Language," Dad warned, "but yeah, he is." Whatever his reasoning, we all agree that it'd be best to try and avoid Bud Fillmore. Scotty and I were extra careful to keep all of our toys well within the confines of our own yard when we played outside. I also couldn't help but keep a wary eye on the house across the street just in case he decided to be extra crazy and we had to run for it. That's when I started to notice Mrs. Fillmore. Almost every time Scotty and I were out and I happened to glance at their house, I would see a tall, slender figure outlined behind the sheer curtain in one of the upstairs windows. Well, I couldn't get a very good look at her. I figured it couldn't be anyone but the missus. Mr. Fillmore didn't have anyone else. She never banged on the window or shouted at us like her husband. She just stands there, watching us. I like to imagine that she was a nice lady, a quiet neighbor who just enjoyed seeing kids at play. I remember my mom saying Mrs. Fillmore was sick, and I felt sorry that she was trapped in her house with her horrible husband. So I tried to be nice and smile and wave once. Just once, Mr. Fillmore appeared at his front stoop and yelled at me for being a pest until I retreated inside. When I peeked out the living room window later, Mrs. Fillmore wasn't in her usual spot anymore. Eventually, we got used to Mr. Fillmore glowering at us as he drove slowly past. His short temper and his loud voice, it was such a regular thing that our fears turned to caution, turned eye-rolling dismissiveness. Bud doesn't own the street. You kids go out and be kids, and if he's a problem with it, I'll deal with him, Dad said. After that, we started to be a little less careful with our things, a little more free with our laughter. We lost a few balls to the Fillmore yard, one or two frisbees, but nothing we really cared too much about, nothing until Scotty's remote control helicopter. It had been a birthday present, and we were both eager to try it out. As soon as we finished supper, we raced out to the front lawn, where Scotty prepared for the helicopter's first flight. Under my brother's inexperienced and clumsy guidance, the helicopter lifted slowly from the ground and staggered drunkenly through the air. In his excitement to keep it aloft, Scotty didn't even realize it was headed right for Filmer's yard until it was too late. "Scotty," I tugged on his arm to try and turn it off course, but it only made things worse. The little helicopter took a nosedive straight into the hedges under Mr. Fillmore's bay window. Scotty frantically wiggled the controls, but the helicopter's blade was stuck fast in the thick greenery. As if he had been waiting for us to slip up, the front door was flung open and he practically pounced on the toy. "What have I told you?" he bellowed. Before he could argue, he had already disappeared back into his house. Upstairs, the curtains fluttered just so, and I knew Mr. Fillmore was watching. I wanted to call up to her and ask her to get the helicopter back, but Scotty grabbed my wrist and dragged me behind him to find Mom and Dad. When our parents went over later, he refused to come to the door. "Don't worry, kids," they assured us. "Next time we see him, we'll sit down and have a real discussion about this." That wasn't enough for Scotty, though. I followed him up to his room and sat on the end of his bed while he paced back and forth while ranting about how unfair it all was. He was fuming and furious, and he wanted his birthday present back now. "But how?" I asked. He paused, his gaze sliding to the window in the house beyond. "We're going to take it." It was a childish, simple, stupid plan with no thought to consequences or punishment. We were going to break into the Fillmore house and get all of our things back. "We'll do it when he goes out next. I can figure out how to get the lock open." "It can't be that hard. Then we just have to find her stuff." "What about Mrs. Fillmore? She never leaves." "You can distract her or something. I don't know. We'll figure it out." "I don't know, Scotty," I said uneasily. "I don't want to disrupt a poor sick lady for a few toys." "Don't worry. We'll just be in and out. She probably won't even notice we're there." I doubted that, but I had a hard time saying no to my big brother. Scotty put his plan into action the very next afternoon, and we were playing a game of horse in the driveway when Mr. Fillmore's garage opened and his car chugged to life. He was wearing his customary scowl as he drove by. The moment he turned the corner, Scotty chucked our basketball off to the side and bolted across the street. I checked to see if Mrs. Fillmore was in her window, and when I saw no sign of her, I followed. Scotty's idea of getting the lock open turned out to be using a small rock to break the window pane on the door above the latch. It was something he'd seen in a movie or something. Immediately, I had images of flashing red and blue lights and handcuffs, and my stomach turned sharply. But my brother whispered that we would be fine. "He can't prove it was us. Everyone on the street hates him." He sounded so confident that all I could do was nod. Scotty reached carefully through the broken glass, careful not to cut himself, and found the deadbolt. It clicked out of place, and he pushed the door open, letting us into Mr. Fillmore's house. I clung to the back of Scotty's shirt as we tiptoed across the kitchen. It was spotless, obsessively so, and smelled of cleaning supplies. Every window had something tacked over it. Old blankets, towels, blocking out the bright afternoon sun, and casting the room into a gloomy darkness that made the room seem small and oppressive. I swallowed hard and forced myself to follow Scotty. Every room was the same, fastidious, clean, organized, and shrouded in shadows. The bay window that I knew he spied on us from had a little hole cut into the heavy, velvety material, just big enough for someone to see out of. I could just picture him sitting in his plastic-covered couch watching us, waiting for us to get close. It was enough to make me shudder. We cleared the whole downstairs pretty quickly, but there was no sign of our things. "Shit," Scotty hissed. He must keep it upstairs. "But Mrs. Fillmore, just stay close and stay quiet, okay?" I nodded, too nervous to say anything else anyway. He had gotten up a few steps when the floorboard on the second floor creaked. Scotty immediately pressed himself against the wall and motioned for me to do the same. We listened to the soft padding of footsteps crossing from one room to another. "Scotty," I whispered, grabbing his sleeve with both hands, "let's just go." "No." He went too far this time. "I'm going to get my helicopter." Door hinges squeaked from somewhere upstairs, and footsteps stopped. Scotty pulled his arm from me and scampered up the remaining steps. Reluctantly, I went up too. We found a guest bedroom first. It was all muted colors and magazines, quality furniture, void of any warmth of personality, like it was just set up for show, never intended for use. At least it was a bit brighter up there. The windows only had a few layers of sheer curtains over them, enough to obscure visibly, but still let light in. The second room was obviously Mr. Fillmore's. It was the most lived-in looking room of them all, and even then, it was only because there were some pictures hanging on the walls and some personal items on the nightstand. The bed was meticulously made. All the clothing, most of which were masculine, hung neatly in the closet. There wasn't even stray hairs in the brush on the vanity. I wondered how someone could live in such a cold, lifeless house. There was only one room left, the one Mrs. Fillmore must have gone into. Its door stood half open. Scotty and I traded looks, his determined, mine silently pleading for him to go. He took a step towards the door. I shook my head, and I grabbed at the back of his shirt again. He brushed me off and placed the flat of his hand on the door, pushing it open slowly. Inside the room was almost empty, except for a large vanity against one wall. A framed wedding picture was on it. I recognized Mr. Fillmore, despite being younger and thinner. In front of the vanity, posed in a tall stool, was a mannequin. She was wearing what I thought of as a 50s housewife dress, white with little pink and green flowers. All over it, a string of pearls and a blonde wig carefully combed back into a bun. Her featureless face was fixed in the mirror in front of her. Scotty's brow wrinkled, showing the same confusion as I felt. We both heard Mrs. Fillmore walk to this room, but there was no one there. "Let's just go," I begged, a cold sweat starting to trickle down the back of my neck. Scotty shifted his weight, obviously torn, and the floorboards beneath our feet groaned. The mannequin's head turned sharply towards us. Scotty leaned back with a yelp, an arm thrown out protectively in front of me. "Liz," his voice was trembling, "run." I stumbled back down the hall on legs that didn't want to work. I could hear Scotty stomping along behind me, and behind him, a rapid skittering. We skid at the top of the stairs and grabbed the railing to keep it from falling headlong down the steps. While I righted myself, I dared to glance back into the hallway. It was empty. Something thudded against the ceiling. We both looked up and screamed. The mannequin was crawling spider-like over our heads. She wrenched her head completely around, turning her blank face towards us, and lifted and fitted towards the wall. She started to descend, the whole time facing us. I was still screaming when Scotty hooked his arm around my waist and hauled me down the steps. We crashed at the landing, tripping over one another, and we could hear the click of the fiberglass on wood as she pursued us. I was crying, scrambling on my hands and knees across the floor. My brother was shouting for me to get up, to go. He grabbed the back of my shirt and practically threw me into the hall. And then Scotty was shrieking. I spun. The mannequin was crouched on the last step, one arm outstretched. She had her fingers wrapped around Scotty's ankle. They were tightening until his bones started to crunch beneath her grip. He kicked at her with one leg, but it did nothing. She started to drag him back, towards the stairs. "Scotty," I screamed, but before I could move, he looked up at me and shook his head furiously. "Liz," he could barely get the words out through the fear and the pain that masked his face, "run." I wanted to stay. I wanted to grab his hand and pull with all my might and drag him out of the house with me, but he shouted again, "Run, run, oh, run," over and over until the words became a garbled mess of howling and terrified cries that chased me out the same door we'd come in through. It was the last time I ever saw my big brother. No trace of Scotty was ever found. My parents searched, police searched. There were dogs and special agents and tons of time and money and energy put into trying to find him, but none of it mattered. It was as if he had simply vanished. Bud Fillmore wasn't a suspect for very long. With no evidence and no history of any kind of criminal record, he was let go. Scotty was dubbed a missing child, reduced to a single box of paperwork that was all too soon moved to the old case stacks. Cold case stacks. No one believed me when I told them what really happened. They all say Scotty must have been kidnapped on our way back from Mr. Fillmore's house, and I was too young to really understand it, that I had gotten confused, and in my fear made up some story using the scary thing I just encountered. Mr. Fillmore's mannequin belonged to his late wife, Sharon. He kept it after she passed because it reminded him of her. Sometimes he moved it around and put it in a window, but it wasn't alive. You understand that, right, Liz? My therapist was fond of saying, of asking. I told her what she wanted to hear, even if I knew it was a lie. The adults preferred it that way. It was easier for all of us. Maybe that was why I never showed anyone the note that had been left taped to the door. Taped and anonymous, that just said, "I tried to keep you away." I don't think it could have changed anything. I don't think it would have changed anything. I knew, though, I never doubted myself at the fact that Scotty has sacrificed himself for me, and up until Mr. Fillmore packed up and moved a few years later, I would sit in my brother's room, and I would stare at the window at his house, and I would watch the second-story window, waiting for the telltale dark figure to appear behind the curtain, waiting for the quiet neighbor that everyone said didn't exist. So I'm going to read some of the comments. Seabisky commented, "I expected the last line to be something like, as I stared across the street at the upstairs window, I saw the mannequin standing in the window. Next to her stood a smaller one, the same height as Scotty." Fire Ryu says, I think the reason Scotty's mannequin isn't there was because Bud was keeping the children at the street away from his possessed mannequin. I don't think he would make Scotty into a mannequin or whatever. Yeah, I think it's a lot like Monster House. You know? If you haven't seen that movie, you should. The animation is scary in itself. Don't tell him I'm dead. Said, if the fucking moron hadn't taken your toys, you wouldn't have went after them. So yeah, he didn't try that hard to keep you away. Did he really think kids or even adults would try to get their property back? Why didn't they call the cops to get them back? This is stealing. As far as I know, it's against the law. So many things could have been done to avoid your poor brother's death and your trauma. I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm very sorry the adults in your life were incompetent. I'd keep the memory of my brother alive, and when you're old enough, track down Fillmore and destroy him and his mannequin. No way I'm going to let that slide. Technically, they could have called the police after taking their ball, because that's not rude. It's theft of private property, and if you accidentally drop your phone on someone's lawn and some old guy makes a mad dash for it and takes it into his house, would you say, aw, shucks, that's a rude person? Oh, and then Zoffer 0001 said Monster House did it first. So, I guess I'll stop there. Thank you all for listening. Sorry this episode's so short, and sorry that it's just me here. Next week, I'll be back to normal. Wish me luck on all my homework and work and everything. Thank you so much for listening. Find us on all the social media at Screen of the Crime Podcast is our Gmail. Thank you so much. And I will add in Cold Air Sister ranting right here.
Yeah, I just saw this TikTok talking about the, if you got gaps in between your LED lights, check now. Because there's bugs if you got gaps in them, and there's silverfish, and I just looked it up, and we got silverfish in there.
You know there's gaps. You know there's a gap. There's gaps because those LEDs can be cut in half, right? Like those are the gaps in the LED.
But they say that they infest the LED light.
You do know yours doesn't have any covering on it, so there's no place for silverfish to go, right?
Really?
You do know yours are exposed LEDs, right? Really? Like, you can touch your LED light.
Really?
Silverfish can't get inside of an exposed LED.
But I thought they said that was behind them.
There ain't no gaps, because again, yours is just a literal strip with an LED light attached to it.
No, mine does have gaps on the wall. That's what I'm scared about.
No, it does not. Yo, you Gucci. If you had silverfish, Lacey will handle them. I ain't touching them. I don't see enough in Minecraft.
Yeah, I don't even know what a silverfish looks like.
Then why are you scared of them? You don't know what they look like.
That's even scary. I heard they look like centipedes.
Nah,
they don't.
They look like little
thousand.
Just play Minecraft and find a silverfish in Minecraft. That's what they look like. They look like shrimps, kind of. They look like little gray shrimp.
I've never even seen a silverfish here.
Because they don't exist. If anything, I got the problems with the LED lights. You're good. Speaking of LED lights, where did my controller go? I try my best sometimes, you know what I'm saying? I attempt to be an older sibling. It occasionally.
Thanks for listening. Don't kill anyone. Bye.